It's Christmas about 10 years ago, and my sons are probably 11 and 13, and my father-in-law, whose birthday is December 14th, is visiting with his wife. And so my wife and two kids and father-in-law and his wife, we all go downtown in a Volvo station wagon to have dinner, celebrate his birthday. We give him his gifts, and then we park alongside whatever that street is to go look at the National Christmas Tree. And it's a bit of a hike across a pretty long fielded area. And we do walk around the tree. It's cold. We're heading back after half an hour, 45 minutes of looking at the trees. And we're about halfway across this field, and we hear the sound of something being broken. And we can see from across the field, at least here to the parking lot, we can see that someone has broken into our car and is taking the gifts out of the Volvo. So my father-in-law's wife, Kim, and I start running after the crooks. And if you've ever seen me run, you realize there's no chance that I was possibly going to catch anybody unless they were really slow. And of course, we don't catch them, and Kim and I finally slow down and try to catch our breath. And by the time my wife and father-in-law get to us, they're both furious with Kim and I. And my wife is looking at me like, what were you thinking? I mean, did you really think you'd catch them? Did you really think you could get the stuff back? Did you really, you know, like, who do you think you are? And what were you doing that in front of the boys for? What were you trying to model there? And, of course, I'm scratching my head thinking, well, number one, I'm thinking I just went on instinct. I was just mad that somebody had broken into the car and was taking these gifts. That's what I think is really driving my behavior. And she's angry with me because, and I wasn't honestly sure why at the beginning. And later, when we sort of debriefed, she said, I don't know why fear didn't kick in. I don't know why you didn't realize. What would you have done if you'd even caught them? What if they'd had weapons of some kind? What if? And I, of course, am thinking, oh, I didn't think of any of that kind of thing. And I'm quietly thinking, well, I think I was being courageous. Yeah. Upon reflection, I really think I just had a different fear controlling me. I don't know that it was courage so much as the fear of being seen as weak or as not responding the way I think a man was supposed to respond. It was that ingrained in most of us, the thought of not doing what you feel like society tells you a man is supposed to do. So I actually think I was modeling something, again, all split-second kind of thing. But I thought I was trying to justify it, and I thought I was kind of modeling something for my boys that you should respond to fear in that way. Different scene, 15 years before that. I work for Young Life at the time, and I'm in it's called an urban intensive in Chicago. I'm a white, middle-class staff person. But about 15 of us, white, middle-class men and women, go to Cabrini Green, which is an inner-city project in Chicago. Oh, thank you. So I was afraid of that. And we're in two vans, and we arrive at Cabrini Green, which is these huge high-rises, where there's a lot of violence and a lot of crime and that sort of thing. And we get out of the vans to go into this community center where we're going to start the program. Literally, we get out of the vans, and there are gunshots that start to take place, or somebody's firing guns. The two instructors, one black, one white, hit the ground. The 15 middle-class Young Life people, we're all standing around like, what's that? Wow, gunfire. Like, almost like we're in the middle of a TV set or something. And the two teachers are on the ground because that's what their instincts tell them to do. And we get inside, and they're, obviously it's a very rich, teachable moment, because they're looking at us like, are you kidding? What were you guys thinking? Did you not know those were real gunshots? And honestly, I don't remember what the rest of them said or thought, but I think I just thought, oh, I didn't realize. It didn't affect me at all, because I'm not around gunshots, and it didn't. In other words, was that fearless or just innocent, naive, ignorant? Of course, they went on to say ignorant. And And that was the beginning of the education that, for me, I have no idea what it's like to live in an environment where fear is much more a natural part of what you're going through. Alex said it well. We're all afraid. All of us are dealing with fear of some kind. And today's talk is sort of an introduction, and you've got several other people coming to talk about fear in a more specific or personal way. But I have to deal with fear every day because anxiety is one of the most common symptoms that people report in counseling. And even if anxiety isn't the driving force behind somebody coming in, it doesn't take long before you, as someone sharing their story or their circumstances, before you begin to realize, male or female, young or old, that fear is an integral part of what somebody is wrestling with that's making them seek help. So I'm going to give you some concepts about fear. But first, a familiar story, because I don't think I'm going to try and introduce what I think God is trying to tell us about fear as well. I know Ed Welch was just here doing a conference, and then I wasn't at the conference, so I'm not sure what he said. So I hope it jives with it. It may not. If it doesn't, then... Oh, thanks. You figure out what you're going to believe. Again, very common story. It's reported in three of the Gospels. I'm going to read it from the book of Mark in the fourth chapter. Again, you know the story. You don't need to read along. I'll read it for you. This is Mark 4, starting in verse 35. That day when evening came, he said to his disciples, "Let's go over to the other side." Leaving the crowd behind, they took him along just as he was in the boat. There were also other boats with him. A furious squall came up, and the waves broke over the boat so that it was nearly swamped. Jesus was in the stern, sleeping on a cushion. The disciples woke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care if we drown?" He got up, rebuked the wind, and said to the waves, "Quiet, be still." And then the wind died down and it was completely calm. And he said to his disciples, I'm going to read it from the message here, "Why are you such cowards? Don't you have any faith at all?" And they were terrified and asked each other, "Who is this? Even the winds and waves obey him." And if you're familiar with Young Life tells a lot of Jesus stories. The focus of Young Life is introducing kids to the person of Jesus. So I spent the first 2 years of my Christian life hearing nothing but Jesus stories. And of course, this story, Young Life, also takes a lot of liberty with the Gospels to make it funny or winsome. I spent a lot of time with this story trying to picture what it was really like. And there's lots of things that could be seen as comical, like Jesus being asleep in the middle of a storm. If you've heard Tony Evans ever give a sermon about this, it's a hilarious portrayal of Jesus being asleep and the disciples being astounded that he could sleep in the middle of a storm. I've never been to Israel, but I've heard that that these storms can be pretty fierce. What strikes me, two things strike me about the story. The first is that they're appropriately afraid of a storm, as any of us might be if we were in a small boat in the middle of a storm on the water. And Jesus rebukes them for being afraid, which I think is interesting. I'm not sure any of us would call the rest of us cowards if we're afraid in a situation that warrants natural human fear. If a lion walked in the room right now, or a gorilla, I don't think we would say to all of us who are afraid, I would be afraid, I'm sure I might leave a deposit on the floor up here. I'm not sure we would say you're a coward for being afraid of this situation. But Jesus apparently rebuked the disciples in a way that if I was one of the disciples, I would have later been thinking, are you kidding? Why'd you call us a coward for being afraid of a storm? Why shouldn't we be afraid of the storm? Didn't your mother tell you when you went to the ocean or in the water, you should have a healthy respect for the water and what nature can do? Why are you telling us we shouldn't be afraid? Is that the message? We shouldn't be afraid in these natural circumstances? But the more striking thing is that after Jesus calms the storm, in some translations it says the disciples were then more afraid. In other words, they were more terrified of Jesus at that moment than they were of the storm. And it's as if Jesus, I don't imagine that the disciples in 3 years of following Jesus, I think they had quite an education in fear. is they saw a lot of people afraid of Jesus. They saw a lot of situations that they thought would scare Jesus, a lot of traps that he went into, a lot of dilemmas where Jesus' response was critical, where it seemed to them like a lot was at stake. And Jesus seemed to navigate, of course it's Jesus, but he seemed to navigate through these fearful situations in a way that astounded the disciples. But there are plenty of times where the disciples themselves were just terrified at what was happening, and in particular, what Jesus was doing. So in this brief episode, and you have no idea why a lot of these events happened, this was not something that had to happen this way. It seems like God and Jesus at times just give us these object lessons for our own sake, so we get some opportunity. The disciples have some opportunity to investigate, what am I really afraid of? And in this event, they have two fears that they have contrasted. And they have an opportunity here to look deeply at the fear that's governing them. So here's some points about fear. Number one, I think everyone has it. Obviously, it's a natural emotion. In my world, it's called a primitive emotion because you have it from day one. even infants demonstrate some kind of fear. It's also called a core emotion, meaning it's one of the central emotions of the human experience. Like shame, like rage, fear or anxiety seems hardwired into us. Number two, you know this, fear is a part of our defense package. You know, the fight or flight kind of thing. But there's a different way to look at fear. Fear is also something we learn to use as a self-protection. So we often feel fear as a means of, as we evaluate a situation, fear is the voice in our head that's telling us how to protect ourselves. If you think of your head, not to say we're all this messed up in one sense, but if you think of all of us, you can picture your head as like a committee, like a boardroom, like a table like this, and in each of our heads there's a group of voices sitting around the table. So in any situation, you're trying to evaluate, what should I do, think, say, that kind of thing. Well, fear is always sitting at the table. From day one, the voice of fear is always sitting at the table in our mind. It's always speaking. It's always representing something to us. There's not a situation or day that goes by that I don't think in this metaphor that I don't think we could listen to fear if we wanted to. The question is not how do you get fear away from the table, but how do you keep fear from being the dominant voice? And clearly, every one of us knows there are times where that voice dominates us, where fear controls us, where it's the loudest voice at the table. A couple other things to use that metaphor. Fear can often split its voice. In other words, you can feel two different kinds of fear at once. A simple example, a woman who is about to give birth is going to feel two kinds of fear. The first fear is of the delivery, of the pain of delivering the child. The second fear is of not delivering the child. So part of her is going to be wanting to deliver the child, but I'm afraid of what that's going to feel like. But I'm also afraid of staying in this condition where I'm ready to pop. Perhaps a better example, if you saw The King's Speech, there's a powerful film about somebody confronting fear. Well, the king is a stammerer, but he's the second son, and he's being called into duty, so to speak, and he has to give speeches, both for his coronation as a king, but ultimately he has to give a speech because World War II is unfolding. But he has this horrific history of stammering. And so the film really captures, particularly in his therapy, his fear of speaking and his fear of not speaking. So he's terrified of having to present himself in public and speak, but he's also terrified of dropping the ball and of not speaking, and of embarrassing himself. So he's got two sets of embarrassment. He's got two voices of fear competing at the table, and you wonder which one's going to win. And that's really what, in the story of the breaking into the car, that's really what I think happened here, that my fear of being embarrassed was just louder than my fear of a natural danger or a possibility of being hurt. My wife was afraid of something happening to me, and so her fear turned in, as often does. Fear often sits right next to anger, particularly for men. So when fear is raising its voice, so to speak, it's often nudging anger. So for many of us, when we're afraid, what it looks like is we're angry. Because we're much more comfortable as men, I think, demonstrating anger than saying, I'm afraid. So we transfer the fear, but it's really driven often by fear. One more way of thinking of fear as a defense mechanism. If you know anything about anxiety, I presume in a crowd this size, there some of you have had panic attacks or anxiety attacks, or you've had experiences of anxiety that seem really unusual to you, abnormal for you. And here's the interesting thing, I think ingenious thing about anxiety, is that it breeds itself. And once you begin to feel anxiety about something, it creates anxiety about the anxiety. This is not something to try at home, but just imagine you're impotent. And then go home and try to be not impotent. If you're afraid of being impotent, guess what? You'll be impotent. Because the fear of it will actually create the mental condition that will then render you impotent. That's what's maddening about impotence, is it? You, if you're thinking about it, it only reinforces the impotence. Well, anxiety tends to breed anxiety. So if you have anxiety attacks, next thing you know, you're afraid of having an anxiety attack. So now you're, the anxiety, and that's the defensive, the point is it's actually creating a series of defenses to keep you from doing the thing that bothered you most. So whatever it was in a situation that triggered some anxiety, what I'll remember is that I got anxious. And then I'll think, well, I don't want to go into that situation that made me anxious. Again, I'm justifying now, I'm going to control my behavior because I don't want to feel anxious again. And it creates this series of walls, so we really can't see what the core issue is anymore. Instead, we're just trying to control anxiety. And that's what the worst cases of this, like agoraphobia, where people can't even go outside. It's often difficult to even get at what the root problem is because they're so consumed with just dealing with the series of symptoms, the different faces of anxiety, and it's hard for us to know what was the original problem sitting at the table that created anxiety, that got anxiety to create all these defenses. And it's an ingenious system that is built into us. Humans are much more capable of sophisticated flight, if you will, than animals are. Again, still sticking with the table analogy, fear can actually listen, if you will, metaphorically. Fear can listen to other voices sitting at the table. Ideally, fear can listen to logic or reason or wisdom. So you can be afraid about something. Like I could have been afraid about speaking this morning. I usually get a little bit nervous. But I can picture, because of experience or wisdom or a sense of faith in God, I can hear those voices trying to calm the fear down so that fear doesn't control my choices and it's not controlling me right now. That's because there are other things that are influencing how we view a certain situation. I'm sure you're going to hear stories of people who have been in frightening situations. Alex Marcus was telling me about training for firefighting. You know, we've all been in situations where you kind of know, look, I'm afraid of this thing, but I have to go through with it. And that the way you get over the fear, the way you don't let fear be the dominating thing, is that some other voice at the table has to rule the table and make the decision for you. And often that is something like experience, or this is just really important, or wisdom, or logic, something like that. But fear can also listen, on the other side, fear can listen to shame. Or it can listen to lust, or it can listen to pride, and be amplified by some other voice at the table so that fear's not operating independently, in other words, from other elements in our minds. Last concept. The guy that trained me, Larry Crabb, had a really wonderful way of describing what's going on if you're feeling any of these three core emotions, if you're feeling angry, anxious, or guilty. And he associated, I can't do the whole thing, but he basically said if you're afraid, it usually means that you have some goal in mind that's important to you. It may even be a goal that you think you have to have, but you don't have control over it. And anxiety is bred in that situation. An obvious example, your kid is on the operating room table and it's a life or death situation and you're in the waiting room. I don't know many of us who would not be anxious at that moment, because what you feel inside is, I need this to go well. I need my child to survive. I feel that need but I don't have control over the circumstances. And that uncertainty between something I need and something I can't control is the breeding ground for at least one form, one major or common form of anxiety. If you've ever suited up for a big game or a big talk or a big presentation where this has to go well, like my livelihood is at stake here, or this is the championship game, and you can feel the fear because this is really important to me that it goes well, that I do well, that we win, whatever, but I know that the outcome is not certain. Well, that's the breeding ground for anxiety. And his point is, the good news in that message here is that there is a beginning of a way to control a lot of unnecessary fear by recognizing, do we really need what we think we need? So when God is trying to change our mindset about fear, one of the things he's trying to change is how much our fear is really attached to what we think we have to have. Largely self-protection, but also, I have to have my kids live. I have to have my wife treat me a certain way. I have to have my job go a certain way. I have to have my health be a certain way. And God is really trying to free us of that have-to kind of experience, which is why God is often in the business of actually putting us in frightening situations so that we have no choice but to look at what's happening at the table in our mind. If you look at the origin of fear, Mike often does this. I think it's helpful to do this. You look at Genesis first to see what's the beginning of some core human experience. And if you look in Genesis 2 and 3, I'm going to suggest a couple things, that fear begins actually before the fall. I think it's the one negative emotion that is present before Adam eats the fruit. And let me give you this picture. You know the story in Genesis 2. That everything's perfect for this innocent man and woman, and they have this relationship with God, and they have one rule, and they're walking in the garden, and they have everything seems idyllic, except God gives one law. And I would suggest that the beginning of fear is at the moment God gives a command or a law. Because the first fear is the fear of responsibility. It's the fear of, am I going to obey what God said? So Adam and Eve, I don't mean that they were neurotic at all walking around, but they were certainly aware, as we visualize what the Garden of Eden might have been like, every time they walk past that tree where the fruit is that they're not supposed to eat, there's some awareness of, okay, there's a law here now, and I better not break the law. And there's the beginning of fear sitting at the table. It may be mild, it may not be very loud or very tempting, but the minute law is given, this is Paul's argument in Romans, the minute law is given, well, now temptation, the opportunity to break the law, and the inkling of what breaking the law might lead to comes into existence. Then God, which is mystifying to all of us, then God allows his enemy and man's chief enemy to be in the garden with him. So we also know fear is existing here before the fall because there's an enemy present. Once there's an enemy present, once there's another voice in the garden who's now questioning what God has said, now you also have fear emerge in Adam and Eve. Because now the fear is, who do we believe? What do we believe? Now I'm afraid of what I thought about God. Now I'm afraid of what this enemy is saying. The minute you sense there's an enemy present, fear rises. Think of the hobbits in Hobbit Town and Lord of the Rings as soon as the Dark Riders show up. As soon as those four hobbits realize they're being chased by the Dark Riders, the fear raises. And these were these innocent, happy-go-lucky little hobbits who had no idea what was happening in the larger world. But once the darkness or the enemy shows up, now fear is a part of their existence. So before Adam and Eve ever eat the fruit, there's an enemy present, and the presence of that enemy has to begin to create some kind of concern or anxiety of some kind, I'm guessing, in them. That's why this is a charged event. This conversation is not a nice, calm conversation where Satan is trying to tempt Eve. A third case of fear. As Adam is watching Eve interact with Satan, and he's standing there, and he hears what Satan says, how Satan is twisting what God has said, and he hears his wife twist what God has said. And he hears this exchange taking place, and then he sees his wife respond to Satan. I can't imagine that Adam is not feeling fear at that point. Because now he's in the bind we've all been in before, where I have to do something. I'm supposed to do something here, and I'm not sure what to do. I feel responsible, but I'm afraid to intervene. I'm afraid to step up. That's why Crabb wrote the book, The Silence of Adam. He's really saying the first sin of Adam was not eating the fruit. It was his silence. God had given him the word, and he was supposed to speak the word at that point. He was supposed to say, this is what God has said. He was supposed to challenge what Satan was saying to his wife, and he was silent instead. And why was he silent? Because he was intrigued or because he was afraid? That's all I can think of. And my guess is it may be both. Because we're afraid of what to believe, and we're afraid once there's an enemy and once there's a temptation, then we're afraid of our responsibility. So then you know the story. They eat the fruit, and then they immediately feel shame, and they go into hiding. Now the fear is a dominant emotion. Now they're afraid of consequences, which is true for all of us. Once we do something that we know we're not supposed to, then the fear kicks in. What if I get caught? What if I get found out? What if this is exposed? What's going to happen to me now? What are the possible consequences of what I've just done? Whether it's something as simple as stopping at Dunkin' Donuts, is my wife going to find the receipt and give me a hard time because that's not on my diet? Or something, is my wife going to walk downstairs when I'm looking at pornography? To, is the IRS going to find out that I fudged on the cash that I took in? Or, and so on. But once we do something that we know, like Adam and Eve, we know this, I stepped outside the line here, the anxiety begins to kick in because we're afraid of the consequences. And Adam and Eve had every right to be afraid of the consequences. Of course they were hiding. Again, now here's the interesting thing, because they were then afraid of God, of what God would do, because they'd never seen God in that situation. They'd never seen God. They didn't know what God was going to be like once they broke the rule. I don't know that they'd been afraid of God before that. But once they broke the rule, now our thinking gets shrouded. Now they're afraid of what God is going to be like. They're not trusting God. They're not believing that God loves them at that moment, because the fear has consumed them, and the fear begins to change or alter our perception of what's going to happen. And then again, you know, God draws them out. He exposes them. He gets them to reveal what they've done. And now we start, as we all do, we start covering up, we start looking for what to blame, we start rationalizing, justifying, because we're afraid of facing the consequences. We're afraid of owning what we've done. You can see all the different kinds of fear that begin to be apparent here, whether it's fear of responsibility, fear of being found out, fear of an enemy, fear of facing our own responsibility. And then God starts delivering the consequences, number one being death. Okay, now death has been ushered into the world. Now the world is going to be cursed. Now, Adam and Eve, your plight as a man and a woman and as a married couple is going to be seriously affected by what you've done here. So by the end of that whole scene, as they're ushered out of the garden and sort of sealed off, now you have the plight that we're all in, which is we are vulnerable creatures who cannot see very clearly what life is really like. We live in occupied territory with an enemy that God still allows an inordinate amount of power in our mind. And we're facing death. And we're living in a broken world. Well, that's now our state. So, of course, fear is a dominant part of how we think. If you're following me, there's no way you cannot be afraid of our vulnerability in this broken world that's occupied by an enemy who still hates us and God. Of course, there's plenty to be afraid of. And the confusing thing for us is God does not seem to be saying, yet, I'll take care of it. So he's really not guaranteeing that he will deal with all of our fear. He's, like we try to do with little kids that get afraid by saying, you know, a dog comes up and growls at them and you try to comfort your kid and say, don't worry, the dog's not going to hurt you. We're trying as parents, particularly of young children, to say, you don't need to be afraid, I've got you protected and covered. And there's a sense in which God is saying that. He certainly is trying to say throughout the scriptures, I am with you. That's a very common statement where God is saying, in essence, fear not, for I'm with you. I don't really believe God's saying, don't have fear at the table, because I don't think God's unrealistic. I think God knows fear is going to be sitting at the table. I think my translation, he's saying, don't let fear be the thing that dominates you, because I'm at the table with you, because what I've said to you is at the table. So begin to listen to what I've said to you and what I'm providing for you. But God is, what we want, what I want is for God, well, God, you know, this, the table would be a lot nicer if you just fix everything out there. Then I wouldn't be so scared in here if you'd take care of everything out there. And God's saying, nope, not yet. There's no promise that he's going to lessen what is terrifying about life. I remember when I first had a baby, I wasn't sure what it was going to be like. I didn't think I'd really bond. I was the youngest in my family, never babysat, thought infants were more or less useless. I didn't know what, I was like, I'm not sure what this is going to be like. I was shocked at how attached I got to Adam. And I had to fly out to Colorado to teach it for Young Life. And somebody said, well, how do you like having a baby? And my first response was, well, I love it and I hate it. And of course they went, you hate it? And I said, yeah, because now I'm really vulnerable. And I said, what do you mean? I said, well, now God can really hurt me. Because if he takes that baby away, I'm not sure how I'd handle it. I'd already, as many of us do, I'd already imagined, okay, if he takes my wife, if my parents die, if I lose all these things, could I handle it? I sort of walked through that sort of silly exercise of pretending I could handle these things. But once the baby came, I was so attached, I realized, I don't think I can handle this. Now I'm out there on a limb here. And if God cuts the limb off, I'm not sure how it'll go. And that was a genuine feeling. I was now afraid that God could do something that would really undermine my sense of things. So what's God trying to do here? Again, we're back to the question, Jesus, why would you call these guys cowards because they're afraid of a storm? Are you really ashamed of us because whenever fear kicks in here? Is that the point, God? And I don't think so. I don't think that's really what Jesus' intent was. I don't know for sure. I really think God is trying to say, you have a choice here. Of course, situations and circumstances and the world is going to be terrifying to us. Of course, you're not going to see very clearly. Of course, fear is going to be sometimes screaming at the table. But what I want you to do is listen for something besides the fear. You know, Proverbs says the beginning of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. I do think God is trying to say, not, I want you to be terrified of me, of my consequences, like I'm going to get you, like kids and many of us grow up, if you think about God at all, you just think he's a big cop who's out to get you. I don't think that's the kind of fear he's saying. But he's really trying to say, I want you to believe in what I'm doing and what I'm providing with you, so that life does not seem as terrifying to you, because otherwise you will not go where I'm trying to take you. If fear is that controlling, you won't go. You will not trust me and go where I'm trying to take you, because your fear will kick in and cause you to hold back. Crabb said before, I'll close with this image. He said, most of us view life as if we're living on a balance beam 1,000 feet in the air. You know what a balance beam is, whatever it is, 10 feet long and about 4 inches wide. Now picture that. That's what he's saying. Most of us live life that way, which means we're probably just lying down and holding on to the balance beam, scared to death of falling, because life looks that terrifying to us at some simple core level. And Jesus is trying to say, it's not 1,000 feet in the air. It's about 5 feet in the air. So if you fall, you can be hurt, but you cannot be crushed. So our perspective is really warped, because apart from God, that life looks that terrifying. At some point, once you get past teenage immortality, at some point, life looks that terrifying to us. The more attached you are, the more responsible you are, the more you confront the enemy, whether it's inside or outside, the more you see what the world is what's happening in the world, the more terrifying it becomes. And God is trying to say, I need you not to be living like you're 1,000 feet in the air. The story, this woman had been meeting with Crabb, and he'd tried to explain this to her. And forgive the morbidity of this example, but it illustrates it powerfully. So she and two of her friends, all three husbands, were law partners in a small practice in Florida. And for, I think, the 10-year celebration of their practice or whatever, the three wives had gotten together to have the three men be in a hot air balloon ride. So the families all went down to the hot air field as the gondolier or whatever they're called, and the three lawyers get in the hot air balloon and start to rise. And about 500 feet in the air, the balloon caught fire. And every one of those women watched their husbands jump to their death. And this woman, who was Crabb's client, told her kids to lay down on the ground. And as she was running to her husband's body, the sentence in her head was, "This is not a 1,000-foot drop. This is not," she said that like a mantra over and over again. "This is not a 1,000-foot drop. This is not a 1,000-foot drop." She was trying to internalize what Crabb had said to her. God is trying to say to every one of us, whatever happens today, God is trying to say, this is not a 1,000-foot drop. Because of who I am and what I've said, he's saying, I will give you comfort and presence and guidance, even though I know you don't see it very well, even though I know fear is sitting at the table, even though I know you're not sure what to do, and you may drop the ball here, but he's saying, this is not a 1,000-foot drop. And he said, he wants us to be increasingly aware of what he's providing, because he's trying to take us places that only that kind of detachment from the world and from the things of this world will give us the courage to go forward. And the distinction is, and fear is a major thing that must be sort of managed or understood in order for us to go where he's trying to take us. Let me pray for us. Father, I suspect we all know you were trying not just to be a presence in the table in our head, but to be the Lord there, to be strong and comforting, encouraging and challenging, that you want your voice to be what we trust most in any circumstance we're facing. And it's difficult for us to get there. You know that. Bless us now, even as we process this for the next 15 or 20 minutes. But even more today, just remind us again and again that we do not need to fear life in the way that we have or did before we knew you. And we're, oddly enough, terrified of knowing you better because of where you want to take us. Give us a sense of courage and grace now. And from this day forth, we pray in Christ's name. Amen.